Good day, and welcome to the Arrow Global Group Half Year 2022 Results Conference Call. Our speakers today are Zach Lui, Chief Executive Officer, and Phil Shepard, Chief Commercial Officer. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Zach Lui. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Giving the brief on our second quarter of 2022, we were happy with this performance. As you've seen from what we released this morning, we generated quite a lot of cash in the quarter, so collections as well as cash EBITDA were helpfully up on the same period last year. We continue into July to see good collection. Despite whatever has played out in the macro, our cash performance remains robust. That has allowed us to continue to progress the deleveraging glide path that we've talked about. We knew Q2 would be up after the fourth quarter dropped out of that metric from last year. We guided that at year-end results in the Q1s. Fundamentally, the progression towards deleveraging remains our strategic priority, and we see good progress towards leveraging continue to drop over time. That is both a function of our improving collections performance, which we'll talk about more on this call, but also a natural manifestation of our business model. What you see in the business model is, as per the next point, having closed the first close of ACO II, we continue to manage quite a lot and a growing amount of third-party capital. That allows us to continue to grow the business and the fee base, both the management fees, carry, servicing fees, while using progressively less of our own money to support that growth. You'll remember from when we issued the bonds last October that we forecasted that when ACO II completed, Arrow's contribution to that fund would be lower than it was in ACO I. In ACO I, you'll remember Arrow committed 25% of the capital, where in ACO II, we're committing 10% of the capital. That means obviously for a pro forma investment basis, the amount of our capital that is required to support that growth and drive the virtuous cycle into the management fees, carry, servicing fees, and obviously our portion of the investment returns is a lower amount of capital out, while, as you've seen actually here, volumes actually increased slightly on first half last year. This effect of ACO II closing will only be seen in coming quarters. We only closed that on the fifth of August, last Friday, and all of that is to come in the numbers. What that'll mean in practice is we continue to collect the back book at $1.00 in the euro, 1.00 in the pound. All of that money comes to us, while on the go forward investing side, only 10% of the money is coming from Arrow and the rest is coming from third-party investors. The ACO II close was very strong. We had a very strong re-up rate from ACO I, as well as some great new names and an even more institutional, deeper investment base. I mean, we already had what we felt was, you know, the best of sovereign wealth, pension, insurance, state plans, et cetera. We felt like we already had a both global, deep and diversified investor base that's deeply scalable. That proved even stronger this time around as new names entered the frame. All of that gives us confidence based on the pipeline we see and the work people are doing and the progression we're making there to get to our $2.5 billion target, which you'll remember is quite a bit up from the $1.7 billion that comprised ACO I. Across all of those dimensions, both in terms of generating cash now and in terms of basically pivoting the business model to continue to have an increasing amount of third-party capital to allow our capital outgoings into our growing investment basis, to basically pivot towards what'll be a deleveraging glide path that, you know, we're happy with, and I think we'll make a material difference to our leverage levels over time. In terms of the investing environment and why volumes were up slightly on last year, we continue to see great returning deals. So at the deal level, returns were 19.4% at the moment across all of ACL1, with the $1.5 billion now having been invested against the $1.7 billion total fund size. So that's now quite a mature fund. That 19.4 is the deal level IRR. So that is what happens if you just bought every single deal into the fund, ignoring recycling and ignoring the subscription facility. With the way in which we manage that process off investors, the actual experience return for our LPs is 24% life to date, and 36% of their investments have been paid for with recycled collections. So it remains a very attractive program, which obviously has led to our continued success in fundraising for ACO2, the successor fund that we closed last Friday. In other key highlights, we've now fully embedded the org structure as we wanted it post the strategic review and post the TDR acquisition. That's enabled us to create very good vertical integration between how we run the business. Phil will talk you through those details in the coming pages, but from a alignment perspective in terms of using the business well to both generate off-market opportunities and collect them well, that's working really in a way we're pleased with. So just to give two stats on that, the fund was supposed to collect $89 million last quarter, and it collected $112 million. So in terms of driving better-than-expected cash flows in the fund, that was an attractive result of having got to this org structure and collected well. And we did almost 100 deals in the first half of 2022, and almost every single one of them was off market. The average deal size was quite small, doing almost 100 deals into a $372 million origination position. The kind of anchor of our investment program remains doing small off-market deals, but almost every single deal was off-market and bilateral, which allowed us to pick off individual loans and individual portfolios one by one, control the diligence process, control pricing, et cetera. And that vertical integration between our platforms and our investment program led us to those constructive figures and good franchise outcomes, which obviously was good for the platforms, good for our investors, good for fund performance, and so was positive across the board. You all have seen that we won a good number of third-party servicing contracts. The reality is the tougher macro environment has led to banks and funds needing more help from our servicing platforms. We own 18 of these platforms, and they really are, in many cases, the market leader or key participants in that asset class in that country. And so as times have gotten tougher, not just have the origination opportunities and the yields there gotten more interesting, but the feed into our third-party servicing business and therefore the ability to grow capital-light revenues has also been an exciting positive, and you see the increase 30% year-on-year. We've also completed the cost savings we announced at the time of the TDR acquisition. And we continue to focus, obviously, in these difficult times to make sure that we're treating customers fairly, we're proactive in both customer and employee issues that come out of what are obviously difficult macro environments. If we turn to page 4, a few more details about the investment program. The deal IRR continues to average 18% historically. That's obviously a very strong track record over 17 years to raise capital against. The current fund, as you see, is performing stronger than that at 19.4, which by the time you add in 36% of the investments being paid for with recycled collections and the way we draw capital from investors, it's a 24% experienced IRR on a gross basis for our investors. Gross in that context means after all servicing costs, but before management fee carry and related fund fees. In terms of the macro environment, I mean, we continue to position the investment basis in a conservative way, 90% of the assets that we've acquired either have real estate security, cash in court, or other types of hard asset collateral. So we continue to err towards wanting to buy NPLs or portfolios or single name loans where the collateral position is strong and defensive. That served us well, and obviously we continue to take that posture going into what remains a difficult macro. We have seen the buy side opportunities increase. I mean, this is an industry where you can very quickly see if you've got good pricing power as you seek to select the loans you want to buy, and as sellers concede to that request, you know your suasion over the process and your ability to specifically almost curate the exposures you want improves. And that's definitely what we're seeing as we go deal by deal. Our ability to be highly selective at the asset level has improved over the last 6 months. I mean, the deals we saw at the end of June were some of the better ones I've seen since the heart of the pandemic. You know, over the last 2 years, the ones at the end of June really started to compare favorably to what we were able to do in 2020 when sellers were concerned in the you know, basically the epicenter of the pandemic. So, again, I think in terms of future returns and being able to pick what we think are the safest, most defensive collaterals to take exposure to, we remain happy with that. We continue to underwrite them cautiously, as you see on the right-hand side of page 4. We tend to underwrite to a 15 IRR with conservative assumptions, and as we're able to collect those loans, as I said, we've collected well ahead of plan. So in ACL1, we're actually collecting it 59% ahead of underwrite. That even without writing up ERC and on a conservative basis, that has led to significant improvements in experience returns, as we've talked about in this presentation. If I move on to page 5, what you'll see is continuing growth, obviously a big growth in 21 versus the pandemic year of 20, but continued sustaining of that growth through this high volume of small deals in 22. And, you know, we feel good about the start we've made into Q3. And so as you go into our historically bigger half of the year cyclically, it's obviously an attractive profile to do that into a macro that's good for new investing in our distressed strategies. I'd also highlight now that from the 5th of August, obviously the deals that we close that are new name exposures will all be 10% ARO participation level, and therefore that will have the effect of reducing the amount of capital that ARO puts out, even if market opportunity winds up enormous, unlike other competitor business models where they're balance sheet funded and therefore need to go more capital intensive to take advantage of opportunity. We've now got to where we want to be, which is we can grow extensively with bigger and bigger amounts of capital into a good investing environment while using less of our own money and therefore deleveraging while growing, which that to us has always been the holy grail of how to make this business as attractive as possible, is get it to where we can both grow and delever simultaneously. And I think that's with what we've achieved on ACO2 last Friday, the key milestone that we've now reached. In terms of the right-hand side of page 5, we've talked through a lot of those highlights. We remain on track to hit our targets on the fundraising over the next 2-3 quarters. We think we'll close that out. We've got good momentum with investors there. We continue to invest strongly against assets with good collaterals. And so with that, I'll pass it to Phil to walk through more of the financial details.
Thanks, Zach, and good afternoon, everyone. Before I talk through the actual performance of the group, slides 7 and 8 talk about the new segmental reporting following the take private and subsequent reorganization of the business. You'll recall that following the acquisition by TDR, we realigned the business so individual platforms became responsible and accountable for locally incurred costs. So, for example, the local finance teams no longer reported into the central finance function, but reported into our platform CEOs. And this move ensured that we maintained the benefits of certain central functions like underwriting, but gave greater accountability to our local platforms. And the new segmental reporting aligns to this new structure and the vertically integrated model with three segments. The platforms segment captures the capital-light revenue and costs from our asset management and servicing and fund management platforms. And each platform receives capital-light revenues for the services offered to either our balance sheet business, our fund investments, or third parties, with internal revenue booked at a rate card which is equivalent to external market rates. And the platform segment includes the combined results of our fund management and asset management and servicing activities. And this reflects the interdependency of the origination, underwriting, fund management services with the related collections and other servicing activity. The second segment is the balance sheet, which captures all investments, including our co-investment through ACO1 and subsequent funds. And finally, the group segment, which reflects the costs of centrally controlled group functions. Slide 8 sets out the key differences between the new and the old segmental reporting. As a recap, the previous four segments were Fund and Investment Management, or FIM, Asset Management and Servicing, AMS, the Balance Sheet Business, and Group. And there are essentially two differences between the new platforms segment and the old FIM and AMS businesses. Firstly, the majority of FIM and AMS overhead costs were a reallocation from centrally controlled costs. For example, the total costs of the finance function throughout the group were centrally managed and allocated to FIM and AMS on a notional recharge basis. Now these costs are locally controlled and platform management have direct responsibility. As such, the costs are included on an actual basis rather than a notional allocation. Secondly, Europa Investimenti, one of our Italian platforms, was previously all allocated to FIM, including its balance sheet investment income. Now Europa Investimenti operates as a platform receiving income for managing the balance sheet investments at an agreed rate card, and its balance sheet investments are reported within the balance sheet segments. Moving on to the balance sheet segments, the key differences between the previous BSB, balance sheet business, and the new balance sheet segments are the inclusion of Europa Investimenti's investments, as I've just explained, together with a lower level of notionally allocated central costs. And finally, the previous group business segments represented the group costs less those costs notionally allocated to FIM, AMS, and BSB, whereas the current group segment now represents the centrally controlled overhead costs with limited reallocation to the other segments. And further details and explanation of the segmental reporting are set out in the appendix to this presentation. Turning now to the actual results, as shown on slide 9, under the new segmental reporting with restated prior year comparatives. The group has delivered a strong cash performance with adjusted EBITDA up 17% to 154 million, driven by a strong collections performance. And I'll talk in more detail about the collections in a moment. Despite the strong cash performance, EBITDA was 49.2 million, some 12.1 million lower than the corresponding period last year. and this was entirely due to 18 million of higher non-cash impairment write-ups to our investment portfolios compared with last year. So in H1 2021, non-cash write-ups totaled 25 million compared with 7 million this year. Stripping these non-cash impairment write-ups out of the result, the EBITDA has improved by circa 6 million from 36 to 42 million, reflecting the growth in our capital-light revenues. The proportion of our total group EBITDA derived from the platform segment, which represents our capital-light businesses, grew from 20% to 30% year on year. And the profit before tax and adjusting items was 1.9 million and was impacted by the higher interest costs and by a non-cash foreign exchange retranslation amount on our net euro liability position. And I'll explain these matters in more detail in one of the upcoming slides. So moving on to the segmental results and starting with the platform segment on slide 10. The platform segment, which represents the capital-light revenues of the group, has grown revenues by 18% year-on-year to 98.8 million. And the growth arises in both the record contract wins made in 2021, and we have continued to see strong appetite for our asset management and asset management services from our customers in the first half of this year. In addition, the growing funds under management create increasing management fees. As a result of the growth in revenue, we've increased EBITDA by 2 million to 14.7 million. The EBITDA margin has been consistent, partly reflecting the investment to build our fund management and origination capabilities, in particular in the area of real estate. Going forward, I expect the EBITDA margin to widen as management fees and income growth outpace the cost growth. Moving on to the balance sheet segment on slide 11. The cash performance has been strong, with collections 110% of ERC and 7% higher than prior year. Despite the strong cash performance, EBITDA decreased by some 16 million to 45.6 million, and this was entirely due to the non-cash impairment write-ups I mentioned earlier, which were 80 million higher in the first half of last year at 25 million compared with 7 million in H1 this year. I'm pleased that we've continued to deliver strong collections performance, and this is shown in detail on slide 12. And emphasises the strong focus that the business has on cash. Collections were 7% higher than H1 2021 at 192.1 million, representing a healthy 110% of ERC for the half as a whole and 118% for Q2. The collections performance is partly driven by the acceleration of collections, a more typical feature of secured portfolios than unsecured portfolios. With the current cost of living impacts and broader economic uncertainty, I believe our performance demonstrates the resilience of our collections and also the prudent ERC assumptions. The strong collections have driven adjusted EBITDA to 154 million for H1 2022, up 17% on the prior year. And we remain cautious concerning the macroeconomic environment with the inflationary pressures and interest rate rises. But I believe that our ERC continues to reflect prudent underlying assumptions. Slide 13 shows the results of our final segment being group. This primarily relates to the centrally controlled overhead costs. The segmental loss has improved by 2 million to 11.1 million due to a number of factors. Firstly, as our funds under management grows, there is an increasing allocation of our group overheads to the fund through designated charges. As the back book continues to decrease and our funds continue to grow, this trend will continue. Secondly, as I detailed at the Q1 announcement, we have fully delivered the targeted cost savings of 20 million and are maintaining a strong focus on cost control. Lastly, we have reinvested part of these savings into the development of our business in areas such as fundraising. This investment allows us to scale our operations and accelerate the transition to our integrated fund manager model. On slide 14, you can see the full income statements, and just to explain the foreign exchange movements and interest costs. As the group is generating surplus income in euros, predominantly due to the growth in management fees and in due course carried interest in our funds, the group is maintaining a net euro liability position. The retranslation of this liability position gives rise to some non-cash P&L volatility. In addition, the interest costs have risen by 8.8 million compared with a similar period last year due to the refinancing following the take private transaction, the costs of the high levels of liquidity headroom that we are running with, and rising interest rates. Slide 15 shows the free cash flow generation, which rose by 19% to 108 million compared with H1 2021. Importantly, the free cash flow exceeded the cash investments on portfolios of 83 million. This surplus of 25 million between our free cash flow and our portfolio investments is expected to increase as we start investing into ACO II with the 10% co-investment level. Slide 16 shows the net debt position and further highlights the strong surplus cash flow generation over portfolio investments as we transition to our integrated fund manager model. Overall, net debt did increase during the period despite the strong trading performance, partly as a result of the foreign exchange impact of retranslating our euro borrowings, which increased the reported sterling equivalent debt by circa 22 million, together with the working capital outflow that predominantly arose during Q1 this year, in part due to the growth of our servicing activity. We expect that net debt will start to reduce, particularly into 2023, when we will largely be investing into ACO II with the 10% co-investment level. Moving on to slide 17, which shows our leverage and funding position. The strong collections in the period have led to a reduction in leverage from 4.8 to 4.5 times. Deleveraging remains a core focus, and we remain committed to reducing leverage to circa 3 times and repaying debt over the medium term. We have a strong funding base with no bond maturities until 2026. The weighted average term on our debt is 4.6 years, and we have over 260 million of liquidity headroom. We continue to see a marginal reduction in our ERC. The 120-month ERC is 4.4% down during the period. As I explained at the Q1 presentation, it is important to note that part of this reduction is due to the proportion of our ERC reported net of servicing costs. Our investments through ACO I are calculated net of servicing costs and are shown as portfolio investments at fair value through the P&L. Portfolio investments recorded at fair value through the P&L now represent 31.5% of our total investments, up from around 15% at the time of launching ACO I. Given the current economic challenges and the impacts that this is having on the high yield funding markets, I believe the strength of our liquidity and funding position and our capital light model leaves us well-placed to take advantage of the opportunities in our markets. Our transition to an integrated fund manager enables us to scale operations and grow our capital light revenue streams without placing strain on our balance sheet. I believe these results, together with the first close of ACO II, show the strong progress that we are making on this transition. Thank you, and I'll now hand back to Zach.
Thanks, Phil. Just to summarize on page 19, we remain committed to deleveraging as our top strategic priority. As we've described between Phil and I over the course of this call and the work we did back when we raised the bonds in October, it is the case the natural execution of our business model leads to that deleveraging. The reality is we continue to grow capital-light revenues both from the fund business and from our servicing franchises, 30% up year on year. We've now closed the first close of a material fund that will be larger in size than the last fund, but with only 10% of our capital versus 25% in the prior fund. And so we continue to collect the back book at 100 cents on the dollar and deploy the fund at 10 cents on the dollar, euro, pound, to drive that asymmetry of collecting strongly on the back book and deploying less while of our own balance sheet while growing the total originations and therefore the servicing franchise on the forward and taking advantage of any market opportunity without the consequence of that on capital. That will just drive, as you particularly layer in, carry and fund management fees, which you'll remember are correlated with NAV. We charge based on NAV and money drawn, and therefore, as these get to maturity, the full peak management fees for ACL1, the growing management fees for ACL2, carry for ACL1, and the reduced capital outlay to support ACL2, all of these things will naturally lead to the deleveraging. So what do we need to do to deliver this? We need to just keep effectively just running the business model in the ordinary course, continuing to grow the fund, continuing to deploy the fund on these revised ratios will create a pro forma return on equity of circa 40% on new investments. That is comprised of the asset return, which has been high teens historically, slightly better than that in the current fund. And then overlaying on top of that management fees, carry and servicing fees on 90% of the money coming from third parties. And each of these steps now being effectively embedded at scale and delivering continue alongside our good collections to delever the business as a structural matter over the coming years. And finally, we need to do two more things to be effective. One is continue to have the leading platforms locally. Obviously, that feeds both better deals to our investment business but drives more capital light revenue in its own right. It also makes us more competitively advantaged on a local level, growing our databases, growing our origination, growing our client base. And obviously, in these challenging times, we need to continue to focus on our customers, make sure that they're getting what they need and that we're being proactive in dealing with their difficulties in a difficult macro. And finally, we also need to do the same for our employees, given the cost of living crisis that exists in many of our markets. And so the team and we have been focused on doing that, and we've taken some internal measures to support that. But all of that taken together, I think, in summary, provides for a business that's delivering what we said it would last October, making the strategic progress that we anticipated and is heading to a place that has a very deep deleveraging profile, allowing us to both scale the business through the funds while simultaneously deleveraging the business, which I think has been the holy grail needed in this space. And I think our business model and execution over the last year, you know, is evidencing that that's exactly what we're going to do. And so with that, operator, I will pass it across for questions, please.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you find that your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2. Once again, press star 1 to ask a question. We will take our first question from Marco Gioni with T. Rowe Price. Please go ahead. Okay, the person just disconnected, so we will move to the next question from Carl Strecker with Guggenheim. Please go ahead. Please make sure you're not on mute. Carl Stryker, it's your turn. We cannot hear you.
Okay. Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Sorry, apologies for that. I'm not sure there's something wrong with my headset. In terms of the first close at $1.1 billion versus the $2.5 billion target that you've outlined, is that a lower amount than might be typical, like having your first close at kind of less than 50% of your target amount? Is that something that you consider typical, or any comment to make on that?
Yeah, I think what we've experienced in the fundraising market is that LPs have been working through their own issues, right? Part of that's a backlog. Part of that is their own portfolio composition has been very fluid. And so you started a year, you know, private equity and VC investments were way up, public markets were way up. You get halfway through the year and all of that has, at least on the public side, partially reversed. And so I think as they've worked through their issues, they've made new commitments in context of that progression. Further, I'd say that the relevance of our strategy has improved over the course of the year. So if you think about, you know, 6 months ago, the chatter of distressed was seen in the backdrop of a very strong recovery from COVID and the government spending sugar highs, and now is seen in the context of inflation and government warnings of severe recessions. So I think as we've worked our way through each of those moving parts, investors have moved at their own speed. So to pick up your question, what I'd say is we're obviously flagging that we're going to get to the 2.5. That is based on the work we've done with existing and new investors. So that's not a speculative, you know, if this were a pipeline and in running a business, you've got, you know, named transactions, or in this case, named investors who are committed to getting it done and taking all the steps to getting it done, albeit getting through those steps at the pace their institution can tolerate given the macro movements, that is why we have the confidence to foreshadow the 2.5, is that we see the momentum investor by investor, name by name, getting to where we need to be. We probably could have waited and closed a number, frankly, closer to $2 billion if we wanted to wait till the end of the year in terms of a first close. And I guess where we felt what made most sense was to close at this level here, which at over $1 billion clearly gives us enough capital to support any immediate origination needs. We'll continue to close out the other investors in flight, which will get us, you know, pretty much to the target over the next 6 months. And so, yes, would I have liked to have had a first close that was bigger? Yes, equally, when we look at the individual name-by-name progression, is that going to be a problem? No. I mean, based on what we're seeing in the matriculation of investors through the process, we're going to get to where we want to be. And so it's just a judgment call as to whether we closed it here at this number and then added to it at the next quarter's update, or whether we effectively waited and we just thought it made sense to close the progress we had and then we'll add to it next quarter. But based on what we're seeing and the progress we've made with investors, both existing and new, it'll absolutely get to where it needs to be.
Understood. And just to confirm, because I think you've alluded to this, but in terms of process, the delta between, say, the 1.1 and the 2.5 target, that's all new investors. It's not that some investors have committed a certain percentage of total and would increase their commitment at a later date. It's more bringing in totally new investors to get you between the 1.1 and the 2.5. Is that correct, or is it a combination of the two?
No, it's all of the above. So we the gap between the 1.1 and the 2.5 will be closed by all of, it'll be some existing investors who are ACO 1 investors who just, when you laid out their committee schedule and their re-up pipeline, are basically closing with us in Q3 as opposed to in Q2. That's a good chunk of it, which is why we've got deliverability certainty, is that we're obviously highly progressed with them and we know them well through the existing fund. It's partially new investors, again, counting only those who have gotten through the process, done site visits, and have been doing the work with us on the docs. And then finally, there are a couple of important investors who are allocating to us across both their 2022 allocation and their 2023 allocation. And so there will be some pickup from people who gave us the 1.1. That's not the entirety of their commitment to us. There will be follow-on from those still inside the timeline of ACO2 early in 2023 that amounts to commitments across their 2022 and 2023 vintage. And so that's why we're giving the confident guidance of the 2.5 is in sight, is that it's a combination of each of those sources that obviously have, much higher confidence on deliverability than if we were chasing new names, which obviously in this environment is a completely different risk profile.
Yeah, understood. And in terms of increasing deployments, how do you think about that? You've kind of spoken to the attractiveness of the current pipeline. I think fund vehicle deployments were about 204 million in the quarter, which is higher than the first quarter, but maybe lower than some quarters last year, I believe, or if those numbers are correct. But do you have, the pipeline to increase deployments? Is it more, the quantum of capital that you have to at present, and that should be increasing with this new fund, or how do you think about increasing that pace of deployment?
Yep. It's a great question. Your numbers are correct, by the way. That's exactly right. As is your comparison to prior year. What I'd say is that it's really driven by our risk appetite. And so what we're seeing in the market is that, obviously, we service more than 200 banks. We've got a very good line of sight into what each bank is doing, what they're willing to sell, where they in their own process of managing their own balance sheets. And what I'd say is that where we are in the cycle is that the buyer-seller price alignment is working at deal-by-deal, asset-by-asset level and not on a wide perimeter basis. So in other words, if you look at past times in the cycle, there are moments over the last 17 years where Arrow's been able to buy, large perimeter transactions where we feel there's really good value for the buyer. And I'd say right now that has had to be a more forensic exercise of going loan by loan, portfolio by portfolio, asset by asset. As you see, we've done more than 80 deals in the first half year to deploy, the 371. So we've had to be careful, and that is more of a reflection of the macro and our risk appetite than it is a reflection of any other factor. It's definitely not a reflection of capital availability. As you see, we still have undrawn money on the current fund, plus now $1 billion of fresh capital in the new fund, plus growing into the full close size of ACO2. When you combine all those things and the scalable nature of our investors, our investor base are some of the largest investors in the world. There's no practical limitation on capital availability. So for us, it's more, where do we see value? And if you think about the macro, you really have to check each position. Each borrower position needs to be reevaluated in the context of the macro, each asset class, what exposure you want to take against residential real estate, against office buildings, against different positions in bankruptcies, against different consumer exposures, you really, really want to be thoughtful as to where that price point is. And so it is more picking up the deals where we really like the collateral one by one, and that's been the constraint on scale. Q3 has seen, I mean, just give an early look of Q3, has seen a bit better start in terms of seeing opportunities that are slightly larger where we're equally comfortable with the collateral. But as you know, Q4 has historically been our biggest quarter, and so it'll depend on kind of where that supply-demand dynamic is in Q4. But what I would say on the ground is that you're seeing the ability on the buy side to be more selective and drive through your will, which, I mean, if you think about it like this, typically, you know, if you want to buy some loans from a bank and a bank says, oh, I want you to take this difficult loan, this other difficult, I mean, give huge examples in another, in a more bilateral meeting, but, you know, let's say they lay out a quarry, I mean, that you've got nothing to do with, or they laid out a residential care home, I mean, things that you don't want as collaterals. If the buy side has good suasion, the buy side's able to say, look, take those out of the pool. We just want this one bankruptcy where the receivable is a state-guaranteed receivable and the cash is already in court, for example. And what you see day-to-day on the ground is where you're able to impose your will on these deals and take just the collaterals you like and leave behind everything else while still buying them at a deep discount. That's where you want to be. And
yep.
That environment is unquestionably shifting our way. And with that, our confidence to deploy greater capital into those attractive deals. You've seen how, you know, we're cautious in 2020 and 21, and that's led to write-ups and performing better than the fund's historical average. So our focus is really continuing to be disciplined on the investment side, because I do think the macro is very tricky, and while still obviously getting enough capital to work to support the fund sizes and the business models. And given the 30% rise in capital light just year on year, we feel good that the servicing franchises are getting the volume they need. And in terms on the investment side, we're focused heavily on risk-adjusted returns. And again, we're seeing the buy side kind of advantage improving materially at the end of Q2. I mean, I think with the onset of inflation and the nervousness from rising interest rates, the banks are more keen to clear their books now, and that's allowed us to have much more buy-side suasion, which we've been able to parlay into being able to select in a way that's buyer-favorable the assets we really want. And that has carried strongly into Q3, and based on, you know, unless the macro miraculously somehow rebounds to the positive, we would expect that to continue in a way that's hugely accretive for our whole franchise.
Yeah, understand that. That's very helpful color. And then I guess the last question or comment I have is around the new segment presentation within the platform segment. Because you're kind of combining the fund management and servicing, you know, into a single segment, you know, it does make it more difficult to kind of understand, because it is two, they're both asset light, but they're, I would argue that the value of the streams is probably different and asset management is higher. Is it possible to provide some disclosure to break out, you know, well, preferably on EBITDA, revenue and EBITDA, but at least on a revenue basis for the kind of those two different fee streams going forward?
Let me take that one away, Carl.
Okay. Yeah, understood. Okay, thanks very much, guys. Appreciate the call and the questions.
Thanks.
Thanks so much.
And we will now take the next question from Marco Gironi with T. Rowe Price. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, and sorry for dropping off before. It was my fat finger moment. I have three questions, if I may, quickly. The first one is about your focus on deleveraging and the progress you expect to make this year. Is it still fair to do you still expect to land at the end of this year in the sort of low fours, as you've indicated before, which I guess implies an EBITDA, by my calculation, around the 300 or low 300s mark? That's my first question. My second is just a point of clarification about the deployment of the ACO funds. Am I correct in understanding that you will first finish investing ACO 1 before moving into deploying ACO 2? And if that's the case, when do you expect to finish deploying ACO 1? And the third question is with regard to the segmental disclosure and reconciling that to cash EBITDA. I just want to check my understanding. Would it be fair to interpret that the platform EBITDA, obviously your group costs, are basically cash numbers, and therefore if I had to estimate the cash EBITDA for the balance sheet business is quite simply the total cash EBITDA of the group taking out the platform and the group costs. So just for a number, for the first half, it would be $150 million. Thanks.
So why don't I take your ACO question, and then one comment on your point and Carl's question, and then I'll pass to Phil for the leverage guidance and the segmental question. So on ACO, no. The way we managed it is we went to each of the existing ACO 1 investors saying that we felt ACO 1 was de facto full for new names, that basically at 1.5 invested against 1.7 total capital, we wanted to hold back whatever liquidity was left to support any follow-on investments from there. And so we got their support that basically all new name investments from the 5th of August, i.e. last Friday, would go into ACO 2. So ACO 2 will be deployed straight away. You won't have to wait to burn off the headroom in ACO 1. The remainder of that ACO 1 capital will only get pulled where we do follow-ons. We've got almost 300 existing positions in ACO 1, so the chance that there will be follow-ons is high, and we want to preserve the rest of that capital to support those 300 positions if further opportunities arise. Just one point on the segmentals is, remember there's strategic coherence around this, in that think of it through deploying the fund. When we deploy the fund, it pulls, obviously, management fees, carry and servicing fees with it. And so by putting those together, what you're really seeing is as the fund is deployed, all the fee income streams benefit, which is kind of the strategic rationale around why those are one segment. It's the same physical action that it drives each of those fee streams. And so, you know, one can get, if one were doing evaluation of the business, one could consider the merits, but one can get very in the weeds of exactly where do the fees show up across management fee, carry, and servicing fees, but it's the same investment action that drives all three, and so that's why we thought it was strategically relevant to cluster them. But, Phil, why don't you take the segment question and the leverage guidance question?
Yeah, thanks. So, yeah, on deleveraging, that's right. You know, low fours is still the guidance. You know, we I said at the end of Q1 we'd be round about 4.5 at the half year, and we remain on track to be low fours by the end of the end of the year. On the segmental, yeah, the broadly speaking, you know you're correct that the group and platform segment, then the cash EBITDA or adjusted EBITDA is essentially equivalent to the EBITDA, and therefore the adjustments that you're making to, you know, for collections versus revenue, which is one of the key adjustments that you're making to from EBITDA on a group basis to cash EBITDA. That's all in the balance sheet segment, so that's correct.
Great. Thank you, guys. Thanks.
Thanks, Marcus.
And we will now take our next question from Lars Dueser with the Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon also from my side. Hello, Phil. Hello, Zach. I have actually four questions. First of all, you have outperformed the curve quite materially at 118% in Q2. However, then I think in the release you state that parts of that was an acceleration of collections. So I guess the question here is, do you share with us the number excluding that acceleration, and can you maybe just comment a bit also what that acceleration was? Was it, you know, a not secured portfolio which you sold earlier than expected? And maybe if possible, can you also break down the collection performance you have seen in the UK in particular, given that's, you know, clearly the home of Arrow and still, you know, call it 40% or so, maybe a bit less of your total book?
Yeah, shall I take that one first? Hey, Lars. I think we give relatively comprehensive disclosure on our collections, but just to add a sort of a little bit of colour, essentially on you know the secured portfolios in particular, then you know we are always looking to accelerate collections. And maximise collections because that drives invariably drives a higher IRR. So you know, yes, we've outperformed the ERC, and that is in part due to that acceleration. But that acceleration is is often a typical feature of what we're trying to do around those portfolios. And it wasn't one portfolio. It's across a number of portfolios, and partly reflects I think the prudence that we have in our ERCs that's been evident through when you look at the ACA1 performance that we've outlined in the presentation. Touching upon the UK. We're pleased with our performance across across all of our territories. All territories have performed well. Typically, the UK is, as you say, it's a significant portion of our book, but tends to be more unsecured, and therefore, isn't performing at the 118%, which is, as I've mentioned, more to do with timing issues on the. And timing accelerations on secured portfolios, but we don't disclose performance by country. But all I'll say is that the UK continues to perform well.
Right. I mean that brings me to my next question. I mean, obviously the cost of living, crisis is unfolding more and more. We get further energy price hikes. In the UK come October and then in January again. Bank of England now out saying inflation peaking at 13% in October. How do you think, you know, in particular about the UK book going into, you know, the second half of the year? And, you know, can you maybe also comment a bit what you have seen so far in the quarter on the collections front there? Are your ERC forecasts, you know, prudent enough, even for that clearly worsening macro scenario?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of points I'd make. I think when you look at our performance against ERC over the past probably almost two years now, we've consistently outperformed our ERC. I think we were prudent at the time of COVID hitting, and that prudence has stood us in good stead. And we reflect every sort of 3-6 months on whether our ERC is appropriate, and you know, I still think that we've got prudent ERC assumptions as we go into the headwinds of the cost of living crisis. So I think that's one thing. And I think the other thing is that we've seen resilience in our collections performance over a long period of time. And importantly for our portfolio, a lot of our unsecured are relatively well seasoned. So we, you know, as we've outlined in this presentation, when you look at the level of ACO1 investments, it's predominantly in secured or cash in court backed investments. We've been less inclined to invest in unsecured portfolios, and as a result, the majority of our unsecured book is relatively well seasoned, and therefore I think that's an important factor in that resilience that I talked about.
Yeah, I would just add to that. You have seen we outperformed last year considerably on a cash basis and outperformed the ERC on a cash basis and didn't take the write-ups that we have done in prior years. And so if you were to look at the cash-on-cash comparison that we disclose, look at the ERC period-on-period comparison we disclose, but take into account Phil's comment that more than 30% of the ERC is now net of servicing costs, so you've got to normalize for that. And then look at what we chose to take in terms of write-ups. You'll isolate out, in effect, a prudent view in that regard. You asked about the current quarter. I mean, July was strong. I mean, July we were really pleased with. So I think in practice, we're worried about the cost of living crisis for exactly the reasons you ask, and hence we've been prudent in not taking in any historical context the write-ups we've taken in the past, even though the outperformance is up. What I'd say is that I'd look carefully at house prices too. I mean, a lot of consumer liquidity, both for the secured portfolios and from the unsecured portfolios, are correlated with the housing market. I mean, that is people's biggest asset and often their best source of liquidity. And so I wouldn't, whilst performance has remained very, very strong and we're pleased, the reason we're cautious is if the housing market were to go down dramatically, that would clearly have a negative impact on the book. And so we feel like the balance we've struck of outperforming but not writing up, and as Phil describes, with a seasoned book that's been resilient, we're highly confident that the ERC remains the right forecast. We do run stress tests on a quarterly basis against that in a very thoughtful way with Oxford Economics and a bunch of very detailed input assessments and calculations, and we think it's a robust position. But you know, I wouldn't, if the housing market remains reasonable, then I'd expect our ERCs to hold up very well, and we continue to outperform on the ground. If the housing market were to go down dramatically, I think that would be the other variable beyond kind of customers' budgets taking, you know, competition for space in the coming months. But I based on what we've seen so far, the prudence has not been needed. We've outperformed, and that's continued into the current quarter. Based on the forward, we'll just have to watch each of the input factors, as we all will, to see just how bad the macro gets. I guess the one thing I'd say is that it is a hedged business in the sense that we keep working down the back book quickly ahead of plan, and in parallel, you know, under the scenarios where the back book is troubled, the forward opportunity is going to be immense, and we obviously have locked in the capital to take advantage of that. So hopefully all of that color gives you a shape of how to look at it over the coming quarters.
No, very helpful, Zach. I guess, you know, the other question related to that would be, isn't there also a double LTV buffer in your secured claims, given that the original loan, which is, you know, backed by these assets, was obviously struck at an LTV below 100%, and then you acquire at the same time these NPLs at you know, cents on the dollar. So, you know, are we really not protected at all if housing prices blip? I mean, it looks to me, if I, you know, use your disclosure on where you buy secured claims in terms of cents or face value, and if I look at GMMs, it looks to me there's you know, call it a 30-40% buffer in terms of where house prices could fall before you would see you know, a very, very bad impact on the book. Is that completely off?
No, you're thinking about it exactly right, and I'll give you some historical context to that, which is firstly, if you look across our history, to go back 17 years and go back, you know, I think inclusive of third-party money, total capital deployment aggregated over that very long period is something like $8 billion. We've only lost money on 1.4% of the deals we've ever done, so that buffer, as you describe it, as the double LTV buffer, is absolutely protective in the way you envision. The other thing I'd say is that if I look at what happened, I mean, obviously we have the benefit of having run this company since 2005, so we understand clearly what happened in 08, 09. And what I'd say there is that the vintages pre-09, you know, did perform at way higher than par eventually. It just took a very long time. And so the reason I mentioned the housing market is relevant is that when the housing market's strong, it's easy to accelerate collections, right? People can always tap into that liquidity either by selling a house, taking out other lending, or other just everyone's balance sheets benefit from the upside of housing market. Where when the housing market weakens, particularly if liquidity weakens, then you do have a slowdown effect. Even if you have the double LTV buffer that protects your ultimate capital, people's ability to raise money, or if it's a secured loan, our ability to get to a settlement, a refinance, a sale of the property, or any other resolution outcome is obviously correlated with the pace of the housing market. So what you'll see is that the ERC remains robust. The risk of capital loss on the secured books remains very safe, but the pace or speed is correlated to housing market liquidity.
No, that's very fair. So if at all on the secured book, it's fair to assume there would be a PV impact from a deferral, but it doesn't look like, based on the stats you just mentioned, that there is, you know, elevated risk of capital loss.
That is entirely consistent with what happened with the 07 and the 08 vintages going into 08, 09.
Cool. No, all very helpful. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lars.
We will now take our next question from Vic Jordan of BitCairn Capital. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much for taking the questions. I just have a couple questions. The first one I couldn't quite catch in, if I just take Q2 this year in isolation versus Q2 last year, the cash collections dropped quite a bit, around 18%. So I was wondering if you can maybe explain why that was. And my second question is on the other expenses. There's been quite a bit of a drop-off in those versus the second quarter last year. So I was just wondering, again, if you can help me understand what the savings are coming from. Thank you.
Yeah, so let me take those. Clearly, when you have secured portfolios, you do get a slight lumpiness in collections performance. So if you're selling an asset in one quarter, then you can get spikes and troughs, and that's the rationale for the quarter two 2021 to quarter two this year. It was just some lumpiness in the Q2 2021 figures. In terms of the costs, I haven't looked at the quarter-on-quarter costs. I think we're broadly 10 million higher for the half as a whole, and we were about 4.7 million higher Q1 this year to Q1 last year. So I think overall, I think you need to look on the actual underlying pre-adjusting items, because I suspect that you're comparing the costs which arose in Q2 last year around the takeover. So if you look at in the back of the presentation with the pre-adjusting items, I think you'll see that we're broadly tracking about 10 million higher on costs year on year, which is largely to do with the contract wins that we had on our AMS business, which obviously requires some an increase in cost to meet those contracts, which is probably around about 12 million of additional costs. We've had the cost savings in the 20 million program. They were partly delivered through Q1 and fully delivered by the end of Q1. So that's around about 8 million for the half year. And then we reinvested some of that into scaling our origination capabilities around real estate and the increased investment we've made in fundraising as well, which is around about 6 million. So that's on an underlying basis that's broadly the year on year movements.
Got it. Thank you very much. That's helpful. Thank you.
Thanks.
And we will now take the next question from Bruno Reed-Cutting with PGIM. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi guys. I mean, most of my questions have been answered, but I'd just be interested to know what the blended fee has ended up being on ACO2.
Sure, it's comparable to ACO1. So we would hope it to be slightly up by the time we finish the fundraise, but it's comparable to ACO1 with a slightly upward trend.
Okay. And then just, I guess, I mean, I know it's way off, but what's kind of the timeline or the doc terms until you can then start on ACO3? Because obviously with ACO2, you had to get ACO1 70% deployed. So just in terms of timing, when would you expect ACO3 to start? And would you expect that fund size to be similar in size to ACO2? Or would you again expect to see an increase for that fund?
So, I mean, for modeling purposes, I would expect a fund every 3 years, and I would expect ACO3 to be bigger than ACO2. I mean, the discussions we've had with investors are that, I mean, obviously these are three-year investment periods and then five-year harvesting periods, and it's all locked up money. So over each of those cycles, we continue to expand the franchise. So we obviously added Maslow in December of 2021. We continue to see mostly organic opportunities to cross-pollinate best practice. So there are a couple of strategies we used to run in Italy that we've been able to transport without paying goodwill into Portugal. Similarly, there's our Bergen platform in the UK, which focuses on small business loans, has been really active. We bought that a couple of years ago, and it was an interesting business had bought a bunch of small business portfolios, and we found some interesting ways to, in this environment, drive really, really good risk-adjusted returns with small business customers in ways that were helpful to them as well. And so we keep expanding on an incremental basis the footprint of what we put in scope. Obviously, each time we've got to work with our LP investors to make sure they're comfortable with those expansions, but obviously we succeeded in between ACO 1 and ACO 2 supporting what is a significant growth. I mean, you guys will remember the first close of ACO 1 was, I think, in terms of third party capital, was quite a bit smaller than the ACO 2 first close. So we've been able to, carry that narrative and carry that track record into growing what we think is the investable footprint, even if we stick to just the five countries we're in. And so I'd expect us, looking 3 years ahead, even ignoring the macro and secondary opportunities and so forth, to carry that forward. I mean, if you look at our servicing footprint, we were servicing circa $55 billion of assets when we first started fundraising ACL 1. We're now servicing more than $70 billion of assets outright, and then with a few partnerships we have, servicing more than $80 billion in total. And so our servicing footprint has grown dramatically, as has, ACL 2 on ACL 1 has grown. I'd expect that trend to keep going. So I think if you were modeling it, I would expect a new fund every 3 years, and I'd expect each fund to be at least ACO 3 to be bigger than ACO 2. We can refine the horizon as we get to it, but I think that's reasonable fund on fund.
Okay, thanks. That's very helpful color. And I think just on that point you raised there, just regarding I think specifically Bergen Finance, obviously, I mean that lending is all happening within the fund platform, right? That's not balance sheet lending.
Correct.
Okay, and what kind of proportion is, I mean, how's that ramped up so far? Is it a big proportion of ACL1 or is it quite small still?
It's the minority of ACL1 for sure. We don't give out the exact compositions of ACL1 in the public markets, but basically we've got a strong franchise on the ground, and it as you can imagine, the amount of need for well-placed capital to UK small businesses. We've got a similar platform in Portugal and would expect to have a similar platform in Ireland over time. I mean, that and maybe the Netherlands, depending on conditions. I mean, that is a good use of the fact that we service such a large asset base and have that franchise. So it was a quite a minority of ACL1. It'll be, meaningful, but still a minority of ACL2.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
And we have no further questions for today's call, so I would like to turn the conference back to our speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
Yeah, appreciate the questions and the engagement, and look forward to catching up with you in November for the next quarterly update. Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.